Welcome to the Passive House podcast, brought to you by Passive House Accelerator, a catalyst for zero carbon building. For news, inspiration, and connections from all flavors of Passive House, check out passivehouseaccelerator.com. Sign up to receive regular updates about events, get your technical questions answered, and contribute to the community forum. There's loads of free information for experienced professionals and people just starting out on their Passive House journey. We hope to see you at one of our construction tech or weekly global Passive House showcase webinars. In the meantime, here's this week's Passive House podcast. Welcome back to another episode of the Passive House podcast. I'm Matthew Cutler-Welsh, coming to you from Auckland in New Zealand.
And I'm Zach Semke, coming to you from Seattle, Washington.
It's chilly in Auckland. We just had a cold snap. I heard the weatherman used a very technical term. He called it a blob of Arctic. It's an Arctic blast of cold air has come up from the south, from the Antarctic, and dumped some snow on the ground in Christchurch. Which is very unseasonal for October to get a fresh dumping of snow, very cold conditions right up through the South Island, and it was just over 5 degrees Celsius, according to my car dashboard this morning. Which is back down to sort of middle of winter temperatures. So Chilly morning, chilly couple of days here in New Zealand.
So you call that an Arctic blast?
Antarctic blast, really.
Yeah. Right. Okay. I don't know how you guys do things down there. A blob. I like the blob, the Antarctic blob. It's definitely getting a little nippy here. I enjoyed the sunshine though. And when I walked to get some lunch, it was very nice and warm.
Yeah.
In my sweater.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and related to that, quick news item from me was from this morning. I was listening to the radio and there was a talk. There was a power emergency. We had a national power emergency this morning, which was really just a North Island power emergency. So we have a cable. A lot of our generation here is from hydroelectricity, which is predominantly in the South Island. So we have more consumption in the North Island because that's where a greater number of people live. And there was an issue with one of the cables that comes up across the Cook Strait between the South Island and the North Island. And added to that, a lot of people like myself had dragged out the heaters that we'd just sort of packed up because of the end of winter and plugged them in and because of this cold morning. And it was interesting that the first response was about, well, how do the grid, the people who manage the grid, they can start controlling some things. Like some people have hot water systems that are controllable by the power company. So the power company can go and turn those things off. They call them controllable load. And that can shed up to 180 megawatts, which is what they did this morning, just to reduce the load on that damaged infrastructure of power transmission. But then the sort of second response after that most immediate one was talking about resilience and how there really needs to be some additional on-demand generation capacity in the grid, particularly around the North Island. And that really irked me. It kind of got to me that the first response to a situation that highlights the lack of resilience in our system was that we should build more generation. When in fact, if you look at the reason why the resilience was a problem, aside from some of those things that just simply need electricity, there's some people just need to have electricity, is that there was a response from people like myself who were plugging in heaters. And if my house was decent and well insulated, then there wouldn't be that demand. And it would be very interesting to look at the relative cost benefit of a big deep retrofit scheme to reduce demand as opposed to the knee-jerk reaction of just, you know, investigating building another power plant to increase supply. Because, yeah, these sorts of issues that do highlight a lack of resilience, I think, are going to increase. So it does raise that issue of thinking about reducing demand through efficiency rather than increasing supply. So that was my very topical item of news, which is still playing out probably at the moment as people try and fix that cable between the North Island and the South Island.
Really interesting. And I think it's our communications work probably for the rest of our lives to bring to the forefront this reality that, you know, building performance, energy efficiency, and, you know, the demand side solutions to the climate crisis are the first move. It is. I share your frustration that it's so often overlooked, yet it's such a powerful tool, and it has so many other co-benefits when you make a better building. So, yeah. Well, speaking of making better buildings, my little piece of news comes from the Colorado Public Radio. So this is going back to the Marshall Fire outside of Boulder, Colorado. And there's a whole rebuilding effort going on. Hundreds of homes were destroyed. I think it's now been a year or two in this horrible fire. And there is an incentive. There is support by the utility there that services the area. There's support for Passive House. And so Andrew Mitchler and others have created this concept of the Restore Passive House that responds specifically to this Marshall Fire crisis and the victims of the fire. And so it's meant to provide an affordable single family house solution for the rebuilding effort. And so this is a great story. It's not a long story. It's a few minutes of your time, but a great listen hearing the first clients who are taking this on and applying this ready-made design of the Restore Passive House to their rebuild of their building and how they're thinking. You're feeling like there's some silver lining, at least after this experience, because they'll be building a better house for themselves, more resilient house for the future. So,
that's completely separate from the Inflation Reduction Act, is it?
No relationship.
It's a local incentive.
Yeah, well, their utility is a big utility that's based in the Midwest, but right, it is a local incentive specifically for the victims of the Marshall Fire. And so,
yeah.
A bunch of folks in the Passive House community, locally, Johnny Resvani, for example, and Andrew and others have been really active in showing the benefits and how valuable it would be to apply Passive House during this rebuilding effort. So
yeah,
there's a lot going on.
Yeah, it's really interesting stuff. I remember talking to Jesse Clark at ProClimate in Australia that when they're figuring out their solutions for weather tightness and air tightness control layers on a high performance building, and in Australia they have a lot of controls about systems that you have to prevent embers from getting into a home. So there are all sorts of special, usually metal grids and materials that allow for a ventilated drained cavity on the outside as part of the rain screen, but they have to be a certain size and a certain material to not allow embers during a wildfire to get inside the building. So there's a bit of a design challenge there, because you want to allow some air movement for drying of the and performance of the rain screen, but you also don't want to allow the building to catch on fire.
Right.
So,
Andrew's been doing a lot of thinking about this. I mean, he lives in the mountains, you know, around that area in a net zero passive house that's also been covered by public TV, I think, recently in there in Colorado. And one of the things that it brings up in the story is the kind of harmony between passive house design and fire resistant design, because one of the natural kind of moves you make in passive house design is simplicity of form, so that you're not, you know, creating a bunch of extra thermal bridges as, you know, with this with an articulated envelope. And that simplicity and form makes it more affordable, it makes it easier to also be limiting the opportunities, the kind of the entry points for embers structure. So I hadn't thought it was really another one of those interesting benefits of simplicity of form, just like there's that benefit for embodied carbon, lower embodied carbon, because it's a simpler structure and you need less stuff to make it, you know, stand up. So it's good stuff.
All right. Well, we've got a great interview to get into for this week. But before we do that, let's do a shout out to our supporters.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you very much to our founding sponsors, 475 High Performance Building Supply, Baxt Ingwe Architects, Glavel Foam Glass Gravel, Minotaur All-in-One HVAC and Dehumidification Units, Mitsubishi Electric Train HVAC US, Partel, Rockwell North America, Stocorp, and Zola Windows. Thanks too to our champion sponsors, Icon Windows and Doors, Prosico, and Source 2050. And thanks to our stakeholder partner, NYSERDA, the New York State Energy Research and Development Authority.
Awesome. All right. Well, tell us a little bit about this week's guest. You got a bit of an intro there, but give us a quick background.
Yeah, well, Carmel Pratt is the vice president, in New York of Bright Power. And she has been involved in the Passive House Accelerator community since the beginning of our Zoom calls at the beginning of COVID, as far as I remember, and has been involved in all sorts of conversation and discussion. And she's, had a very impressive career at a young age. I mean, she's taking the high performance building world by storm here, after earning her BS in architecture at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. Anyway, she's doing really interesting and important work in New York, and we dive into that, as well as the context of energy policy in the city in this conversation. So I hope you enjoy it. Welcome, Carmel Pratt, to the Passive House Podcast. It's really great to have you here today.
Thank you so much for having me, and it's great to be.
Yeah, definitely. It's I feel like I know you in person, but it's only been virtually. I think you've been part of this Zoom community that we've been building up the last couple of years, and we've really enjoyed getting to hear a little bit about your work as you've interacted with folks and asked really smart questions and things at the Passive House Accelerators program. So now it's fun to dive in deeper. So this is awesome.
Yeah, definitely happy to be here, and just happy with the community that you've created for creating space for those opportunities.
So, well, yeah, obviously, yeah, a team effort by definition. So you are a CPHC. You're a Lead for Homes Green Rater, a HERS Rater. You have your BS in architecture from New Jersey Institute of Technology. You're vice president in New York at Bright Power. You've just got a really impressive career path and at an early age. So could you start by telling us about that? Speaking about what drew you to architecture in the first place and then to sustainability and passive house, and just talk a little bit about that journey.
Sure. I think at the heart of that journey is curiosity and wonder for the world. So from a young age, having the opportunity to live in different places and explore the natural environment and the built environment, just, made me really interested in like the spaces that we create. And I thought that meant that I wanted to design them. And then I realized, like, actually, there's like all these other kind of peripheral things happening in, you know, an architect has a very like wide kind of spread job title, right? They do a lot in a built environment. But I really, you know, was kind of brought up to have a passion in the natural environment and in conservation. And so when I found out that there was like this niche area where those two could marry, I dove kind of, you know, head first. And that was really after like my first year of school, studying architecture and, you know, doing the whole studio life and the very crazy hours on that 5-year track to architecture as a career, you know, like, architecture as a career. I realized that I wanted to actually focus on the sustainability side and the conservation side. And that led me to a really great program that I'll shout out through the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, that at the time had an integral sustainability program out of India in this intentional community, I'll call it, in the south side of India, that kind of opened my eyes to what that marriage of built and natural environment really looks like on a person scale, and then on like a community and, you know, kind of city larger scale, as well as the rest of the planet. And then I, you know, started working at Habitat for Humanity doing insulation and air sealing and helping them run their ENERGY STAR certification, and then really just kind of went deep into the, you know, the energy efficiency, sustainability kind of consulting space from there. And after some time at Stephen Winter Associates and the Levy Partnership, I've landed here at Bright Power for just exactly 2 years to the day.
Wow.
Almost.
Wow. And tell us about that, your role there at Bright Power. What does that entail?
Yeah, so I lead a couple of teams that primarily do green building certification, consulting, commissioning. So both on the design and construction side, you know, we do a lot of passive house certifications. So both as the CPHD role as well as the verifier role. And my role is also kind of at a higher level strategically being involved with our policy working group. Bright Power is, you know, very heavily involved with and kind of comes to the table to help have a voice for our clients when it comes to both city and state level policy work, as well as like incentive programs with NYSERDA and Con Ed. And helping to, I hope, mentor and be like a technical resource and advisor to other people, both internally in the company as well as externally to our project.
Awesome. Yeah, that's a lots of different hats there to wear. And I'm really, I know you have some ongoing multifamily passive house work that I really want to dive into, as well as, I mean, you just mentioned the policy work that you're involved in. And I know that you've been kind of focused on the energy policy work in New York City. You've been thinking about it, questions of embodied carbon. So we have a number of topics to dive into. Where should we start? Do you want to talk about the policy work?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, that's like very exciting and relevant at a national level, of course, with the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, and how that trickles down to a lot of the work that we do across state lines and across programs. How that, I think, most recently has been trickling down to our projects is a lot of the incentive programs that we've been working within that help to fund gaps for, maybe developers that are like approaching passive house for the first time or looking to, you know, to do a just higher performing project than they've done in the past, where NYSERDA or Con Ed would come in and, you know, fund a little extra money to do the kind of technical advisory work that goes into that, the modeling, as well as the installation of the procurement and installation of higher performing products. And those funds were starting to dry out, and the programs were, you know, starting to sunset. And so we're seeing more funding coming back into those programs because of the latest policy. And that's really exciting. At the city level, we're seeing, you know, these great kind of sweeping local laws that are helping to push all of this, this kind of movement towards passive construction and towards electrification with the fossil fuel ban most recently, that's really just accelerating electrification in a way that we weren't seeing before. It was, you know, more elective, and there was a lot more hesitation on that side. On the embodied carbon side of policy, at the state level, there was a low carbon concrete act passed that requires all state funded, like infrastructure, large infrastructure projects to procure low carbon concrete.
It just makes so much sense. I mean, it's just low hanging fruit, right? I mean, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, that's where I was just going with this. Right. Like this isn't anything new. Like, you know, it this was existing out in Marin County in California, for example, for a couple of years now, and we're seeing good good collaboration and, you know, learning and adoption across state lines, across fields in a way that's much more accelerated than before. You know, policy and law has been a very slow process from my limited experience. But we're seeing a lot of really exciting movement in the last, even just, you know.
Yeah, you know, and I think listeners to the podcast probably have heard about Local Law 97, and which requires, I think it applies to all buildings in New York City that are 20,000 square feet or larger. Maybe there's some exceptions, right? Some carve outs for affordable housing and things, and requires them to hit certain carbon emissions caps, right? Or to meet certain carbon emissions caps by 2024 and then 2030, and there's probably another date, but certainly by looking out to 2050, right? And I mean, are you seeing, is that starting to drive action in the city, is there backlash that you're seeing? I mean, what do you, how are you feeling about where Local Law 97 is in terms of implementation?
Yeah, it's certainly driving thought and some action. Where, you know, I think there is different sides of the spectrum in terms of people waiting for the final rulings to come out before making any crash decisions and actions. And then there were people that were like, we don't care that we don't know the rules. Like, we know that some level of this is coming down the road. Like, how can we, you know, be changing our thought process and designs and outlook now, you know, kind of getting ahead of that. So there's been a spectrum of impact, I think, was your question in terms of what we're seeing, you know, how we're seeing that local law take effect, you know, on projects. And you know, that law goes hand in hand with a lot of these other things. The fossil fuel ban that I mentioned, there's also the building energy efficiency rating system that is, I think, making waves and causing you know, people to take action, and then of course once the penalties start to hit, you know, up to now we just have these estimates and we have this like kind of what if scenarios that we can play a bunch of different ways and think through and to our best knowledge plan for. But I think once we start to see you know, in the next 2 years the penalties come through, and as the shifts and the carve outs really start to, you know, come to light, we'll see even more action. Right.
And you just alluded to the energy efficiency rating system. And for people who don't know, that includes a letter grade, right, that's displayed at the ground, at the street level for a building's performance, right?
Yeah, right. And so we're seeing, you know, projects that are like LEED Gold and they have a C letter grading. It's like, what's going on here? You know, and it's a good opportunity to remember that even if you achieve some certification, whether it's Passive House or LEED, you really have to visit your building, you know, every year at the very least, if not quarterly, to see what's happening operationally and how you're actually performing and, you know, doing benchmarking and analyzing.
Sure. Performance. You also mentioned the Inflation Reduction Act, the IRA, and I'm incredibly excited about the IRA. I mean, I was blown away that it actually came through there at the last minute. And you know, I think it's really encouraging. And I've been curious about what implications that has directly for Passive House uptake and development. But it sounds like you're seeing the potential that could play an important role in the city. Is that true? Or how do you see those investments potentially supporting, I guess, Passive House adoption?
Yeah, so for the time being, from my understanding, we're seeing it more on the mechanical systems side, on like the non-passive side. But that is a big kind of piece of the puzzle. And, you know, when we're talking about the cost increase to design and certify a Passive House building, typically there are, you know, more expensive. An ERV, for example, is much more expensive than your typical ventilation strategy. So funding those gaps, I think, will help in terms of the broader adoption of Passive House. And then we are seeing Passive House written into the various funding agencies that have programs that, that incentivize high performance buildings. So that's HCR, New York State HCR, homes and community renewal that fund affordable housing at the state level, you know, bake in Passive House into some of their clean energy fund money. And so projects get scored higher and are potentially going to be funded at a higher level if they're pursuing Passive House, as an example. Same thing at the city level with HPD, the Housing Preservation Department, and same thing with NYSERDA. So they look to Passive House as a way to create a framework for what a high performance building is and why a building, should be afforded more subsidy and more of that money getting funneled down.
So that seems like a great segue then to your work in the ground on projects, because I know that's like that world of looking at, you know, multifamily Passive House affordable projects and how to put together the financing and the subsidies to make those real. That's probably a big part of your life. And I know you have at least three kind of key projects going. One that just finished, which is Park Avenue Green, and then a couple others that are underway. Chestnut Commons, and is it Vital Brookdale, or is that how you say it? Pivot to those? And I don't know how you want to start, but it'd be great to hear about kind of the scope of these projects. What key learnings you're gaining from them? Advice for others who are embarking on projects of this scale. I mean, these are really significant buildings.
Yeah, sure. And I love the question in terms of what we're learning from them, because it is always a learning opportunity. You know, every new project, we like learn and adjust from the previous. And, you know, starting with the one you mentioned, Park Avenue Green, which actually completed years ago. It was completed before I came to Bright Power, but it's an ongoing project for us because we are doing ongoing like monitoring and verification at a very detailed level with our Mobius service, our like building energy management service. And we're feeding back that information to NYSERDA, to the building operator, but also that is eventually going to be open source information, you know, and white papers that are going to be available to the community. And that project in particular is interesting because Park Avenue Green is a building, it's a building that's next door to basically the same building that was built to like only LEED Gold. I say only LEED Gold because from an energy perspective, the Park Ave Green achieving passive house was, you know, intended to be much, much lower energy use and higher performing. And so we're comparing those two buildings, which is an interesting ongoing insight. And there's some quirks with that building that we figured out. You know, it's funny, again, it completed about 2 years ago and it's already like old news in terms of like the systems that are used there. There's a cogen and there's gas on site and, you know, heating and heating is through a VRF system, but hot water is still using the condensed gas boiler and it's like, you know, already like behind the times.
It's just the way law and right. It's just the way it goes though. These take so many years to put together. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But it did spark you know, first of all, it showed it was, I think it was the first like CS 2015 project certified at this scale, like a large multifamily project. And it showed that it's possible and it showed that it's exciting and that it can lower operational costs on an ongoing basis. But then it also like, you know, it's like who has the biggest
cost, right. Right. The first widest, the first this, the first that. Yeah. Units,
whatever. Yeah. Yeah. So and now we're seeing that, right? Like every record is being broken and the boundaries that we thought were set on passive house have just continually been not real. Like we can work beyond them. And so Chestnut Commons and Vital Brookdale are also good examples of just really large scale, you know, 200, 300 plus unit building that might not have the typical like form factor and low surface area kind of that you look for in a passive house, but can still, using the passive house principles and using certification as a framework, create just a much better, much higher performing building. What we're most excited, I think, about all these projects is like having more ongoing data. Right. So as we complete a project and we hopefully put it into our energy analysis and monitoring software where we're, you know, tracking utility bills over time, we are showing the connection between ongoing performance and, you know, what we're modeling and estimating through the passive house certification process. And I think that's been really eye-opening and useful. And that was, from my perspective years ago, the barrier to entry was like the proven part of it was not there yet. We didn't have a bunch of buildings online that we could point to and say, yes, they are doing what we intended them to do. And also, why are they not? Like in Park Avenue Green's case, what is happening with the cogen that we are still seeing a really high like gas use and, you know, not as low of a electric use as we thought with that cogeneration. So yeah, definitely. A lot of learning.
Absolutely. I mean, that you're on the leading edge here. So, and I, you know, the sharing that learning through publishing research and, telling stories about the projects is so, vitally important to the community. So, you know, really appreciate that. Speaking of reports, and I think that you may have alluded to also some future research stuff that you all are or papers that you're thinking about. I think last year, Bright Power co-authored a report, and it's called The Multifamily Passive House: Connecting Performance to Financing. And that was co-authored with the NYC Department of Housing Preservation and Development, Community Preservation Corp, and Stephen Winter Associates. And its subtitle was How Energy Efficiency and Operational Savings Can Provide Additional Ongoing Cash Flow. So could you just tell a little, tell us a little bit about that report and also what you have in store for next steps and research? I mean, you because this is a report that brought together, I think, six passive house case studies, two of which were certified, right? And maybe now more of them have been certified. So, but they're kind of, and so it took a look at their energy use, compared it with a baseline. Could you share what the findings were? Do the operational savings provide an opportunity for increased financing?
Yeah. So the moral of the story is a resounding yes. And you know, our partners in that research were financing agencies, right? HPD and CDC at the city level that helped in understanding and underwriting to these savings and funding these projects. And so it you know, did show what I think we intended to show, which was that especially like electrically heated passive house buildings operate at less cost. And here's this report to show you why you should underwrite those savings and why it's worth investing in those things. What's really exciting is that the next step, we finally got some additional research funded to go back, pool more buildings than just these six, right? Let's pool all of the buildings that we've modeled for passive house certification. Let's pull in all their energy data, operational ongoing data, and actually create a tool that helps you estimate and underwrite energy savings in a faster way and in a way where you don't have to hire a passive house energy modeler or any energy modeler to help you figure out what those future projected costs should be and what the savings should be over what baseline. And so our strategic initiatives department at Bright Power is working on a really exciting tool, again, with CPC, with the Community Preservation Corporation, to essentially create a utility estimating and underwriting tool that helps both developers and funders get to that question of like, well, how much operational cost savings are we going to have a lot quicker and at virtually no cost? And so that we can start to make those, what were like risky assumptions, start to make them a lot more confidently and keep funding a lot more of these buildings. And
so buildings. Vital. I hope that is a smashing success, because it makes so much sense for affordable housing providers who are holding on to buildings are realizing those ongoing savings. So there's not that kind of split incentive that you might, that a developer who is going to sell the building might experience. And so, so then to be able to then really quantify and take advantage of that, happy reality, to finance the upfront cost of passive house is with those ongoing savings is, you know, so important. So that is awesome. Wow. So,
it's exciting.
This is, your work is so cool. So, and we've covered a lot of ground here. Is there anything else that we haven't touched on that you want to share before we close up?
I think I'm just going to praise the Passive House Accelerator and the community back to saying, you know, with all of this exciting stuff going on and where the industry has kind of gone in such an accelerated rate, I want to continue to praise those that are creating an open source and open space for the community to grow to mentor and bring people, young people with like eager minds and good ideas into the space, because the more inclusive it is and the more hardworking, passionate people that we have in this community, the more impact we can make. So, if you are, seasoned in this community, find someone to mentor. If you are just looking into kind of understanding, getting into the space, find a mentor. And I hope the Passive House Accelerator community can continue to be that space to kind of, promote that and incubate great ideas.
Well, well said. And thanks for the kind words. I mean, it's just a manifestation of the kind of spirit, I think, that is in this community of Passive House. There's always been, the years that I've been involved in this work, in Passive House in various ways, there's always been this generosity to share in, that is maybe not always the norm in these industries. And so it's been great, but very well said. And I'm really excited to when the time is right to have you on the Project Showcase, if you're so willing to share about these new projects that are coming online, because it'd be really fun to dive deeper into that with everybody.
For sure. Yeah. And we have a lot of partners that would be excited
absolutely
to be involved in that.
Well, fantastic. Thank you so much, Carmel. It's been a pleasure to sit down with you for the podcast, and I hope you have a great week.
All right. Great interview. Thank you for that, Zach.
Absolutely. It was fun. What do you think?
There was some really great stuff in there. We've talked about Local Law 97 a few times on the show before, and I feel like I'm starting to get some familiarity with that.
Yeah.
But for people that are outside of the area, that's essentially a pretty leading piece of legislation that requires energy efficiency in the local New York area, right?
Yeah, that's right. So it applies to buildings of 25,000 square feet or larger in New York City, with some carve outs for I think some affordable housing projects, and I think there's another category of building that I think gets some sort of carve out. And it sets greenhouse gas emissions caps that I think begin in 2024, and then they ratchet down. They become more and more stringent until 2050.
Yeah.
And so this is a key piece of bringing emissions down in line with the goal of limiting warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius or to 1.5 degrees Celsius. It brings fines. So these building owners will be subject to civil penalties when they exceed those caps. And initially the cap is pretty lenient in 2024. So it's not a lot of building owners will be impacted yet. But then by 2030, people are going to be feeling it, and more and more buildings will fall under its kind of impact. So Passive House is a kind of proven way to jump the queue and be under the most stringent camp. Bringing emissions below the most stringent camp. So there's a pathway forward that we know how to do. And the report that she talks about, looks at what, six buildings, six Passive House buildings, and five of the six would comply with the 2050 cap. So one of the buildings that is not actually making certification wouldn't comply with cap. Anyway, it's sparking a bunch of conversation about about building energy efficiency. And in addition to that whole the disclosure, that kind of the report card that buildings now have to display at street level.
Yeah, so you've got that as well. Everyone having to put a label on the the building, and that's for all buildings, right? All existing buildings have to have display that label.
Yeah, it's a good question. I don't know if there's a square footage
or a certain
square footage, like size. You know, like I don't know that a townhouse would have to do that, but and that's that's separate from Local Law 97, so it's another progressive energy performance law in the city.
So coming back to the report and kind of the basis of some of the research there, it's awesome to see that real life performance being measured, and I think over time that'll provide an even more valuable and increasingly valuable data set to look at the correlation between passive house design construction and then what that looks like in real life performance, because it helps optimize that design, but it also helps tell a great story about passive house and the process and what that can do in terms of performance and results in the real world. And I remember talking on the show a while back about the possibility for software to get involved to help optimize that design process and simplify the design with a bit of a almost using AI.
Prudence Ferreira.
And this reminded me of that, of having that data that sort of feeds back into the design. And one of the things I really liked about what you talked about was that makes it more affordable and more accessible to people. It's not just about making it a niche for just those that can afford an expensive architect, but it potentially opens up really clever design to the masses.
Yeah, right. If the lenders take these numbers to heart, and that the fact that the passive house savings could leverage an additional $2 to $13 per square foot in debt. So that's, I don't know what, I think $10 per square foot is roughly $100 per square meter, right? As a reference point, you know, that's a big deal. And with multifamily buildings, with new construction in multifamily, we're in New York or Massachusetts, we're seeing a cost delta of like 2% or something. So it would readily cover that. And, the kind of carrying cost for the owners would be the same. Assuming they're able to kind of realize the savings of, there's all sorts of kind of split incentive questions and stuff. But anyway, the point is that, the research they've done, I think really helps lay out the case to lenders to say, this is a real, these savings are real, and therefore mean that there's more cash available to service a little bit more debt.
Yeah. It's exciting stuff. And jumping right back to the beginning of the interview, one of the things that she talked about was the idea of being more than a designer. Not saying that being an architect is not a wonderful thing and is very complex and includes a lot of skill. But I quite like that idea of there being a lot of value to add over and above the design process of the aesthetic and all the things that the building's got to do operationally. And I think that's the real value of a passive house consultant and or someone who's just looking at the not just the energy but also the health and the well-being of the occupants and the carbon now as well. There's so much that you can do as a professional to add value in other ways of being that aren't necessarily just being a traditional architect or even a traditional engineer, certainly a mechanical services engineer. You can sort of broaden that out to just look at look at the whole efficiency and effectiveness of the building. And I thought that's quite a neat way of looking, particularly if you're early in your career thinking, do I slot myself into a traditional architect role or broaden that out to some of these new roles that are opening up, particularly on the carbon side. I think if you get your head around carbon accounting, then the world's your oyster at the moment in terms of careers.
Yeah. Yeah. There was just a amazing article in the Atlantic Monthly by Robinson Meyer, I think is his name, who is a writer. You know, he's been on the climate beat for some years, and talking about in the US the impact of the Inflation Reduction Act. And a report by Credit Suisse, I think is the name of the bank, that looked at the Congressional Budget Office estimate of the spending that will be unleashed by the Inflation Reduction Act, both with these tax credits that basically don't have a limit. Like they'll just be, they're open-ended. They don't sunset it, you know, at once a certain amount of money has been given. So, and then the private investment that's going to leverage. And so what Credit Suisse is arguing is that the Congressional Budget Office underestimates the spending that's going to be unleashed by the IRA by half or by, you know, so basically they're saying it's going to be whatever, 300 something billion. It's going to be double that.
Wow. Yeah.
So the point of his and his predictions in the article are that, you know, we're at the cusp of complete sea change in industrial policy and investment, and that we're like, it's going to, what's going to unfold in the next few years is going to be really a really big deal. And yeah. So this approach to architecture and understanding of the role of the designer and the passive house designer and stuff, I mean, that's just like, that's one kind of slice of these new careers. Yeah. Like it's not,
yeah.
This is not, I think he was talking about the analogy of what tech was 10 years ago or 12 years ago. He's of a younger generation. So he's recalling, you know, when he was first entering the workforce, people who were in tech were kind of like geeky, dreamers a little bit.
Yeah.
But then that transitioned into, no, it's like, tech is the thing that is the no-brainer choice for a successful college graduate, or certainly for many of them, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what's about to happen with positions like Carmel's, and that you know, that used to be for geeky dreamers.
Yeah.
But so much capital is about to be unleashed that's really going to change, and it's going to be, you know, you're not doing it because you're a dreamer. You're doing it because that's where the action's at. So it was very encouraging to read that article and to I hope he's right, because
yeah,
we certainly need it.
Yeah, it was certainly heading that way. Good stuff. All right. Well, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Very inspiring, as always.
Indeed.
What have we got coming up?
Yeah, there's a lot coming up. At the Accelerator this Wednesday, so Thursday your time, at Passive House Accelerator Live Construction Tech Edition, we'll have Kevin Brennan speaking about systematic moisture management innovations and monitoring. And if you haven't caught Kevin at one of these presentations, he's fantastic. So much depth and of experience, and you know, great tips. And he's also just a really gifted educator. So please join us for that. And we'll also see a presentation related to Kevin's presentation by Floris Buisman of 475 High Performance Building Supply. So we'll see you now on next week. And then if you're in New York City, we are doing an in-person event in collaboration with the organization Brick and Wonder, which is a community of AEC professionals in the city and beyond. So this is going to be a live event on October 13th at 6 p.m. Eastern at Brickworks, New York City. And it's called High Performance Building Cocktails and Case Study. It's free, so you can come have your free cocktails and listen to some great presentations. Michael Ingwe will be the moderator for that. Lois Arena of Stephen Winter Associates will be presenting. And then we'll also be hearing from the designers of the Batons Residences from Cook Fox. So it's going to be really great. So if you're in New York City, you're lucky. I wish I was there.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's going to be
not just
good.
For the cocktails.
Yeah, no, no, absolutely. come for the cocktails, stay for the high performance insights.
Yeah.
and then, of course, we have FiasCon coming up in Chicago, the big conference of FIAS that FIAS does every year. It's in Chicago this year at the last week of October. And the a couple of things that we want to share. One is that for the first time ever, they're doing something called FiasCon Youth, which is a presentation, a session by youth and for youth that will be on Thursday, October 27th. So the first day of the core of the conference in late morning. So if you are planning to go to FiasCon and you have a child, particularly probably if they're like maybe 12 and up, I think this is going to be content that's pitched to high school and college age, but certainly a 12-year-old could take it in. It's going to be great. Dylan Ingwe is actually one of the presenters.
Awesome.
Folks, yeah, a lot of folks know Dylan. He's doing an internship right now at Pascal's Institute, and we'll be back for this presentation. It's great stuff.
Oh, great.
Also a team of students from a high school that is doing a high performance building trades program where their curriculum is to build a house will be there to talk about their work. So that's going to be cool. So we'll include a link. Of course, we're doing podcast interviews at FiasCon. And Matthew, are you going to be joining us?
I am going to be joining you. That's super exciting.
It is.
We'll be hanging around with microphones and chatting to people.
That's right. Yeah. So we'll have you and Mary and me, and maybe we'll have a couple of guest interviewers interviewing people. I am so excited that you're coming. It's going to be great. So that whole effort is underwritten by two fine organizations, StoCorp and Zola Windows. So I can't say thank you enough to StoCorp and Zola for supporting this effort and getting Matthew to Chicago. It's awesome.
Yeah.
And then on Friday, I'm sorry, there's a lot of announcements here, but I also want to share that on Friday, we are partnering with FIAS Alliance to co-host the after party of FiasCon. So formerly known as the Mixer, the after party will be on Friday night, and it's going to be at a really cool spot, historic spot in Chicago that will be, the location name will be divulged on Friday afternoon. So it'll be a surprise. But the tickets used to be $125 a piece. Now they're $40 a piece. And the reason that they're reduced in price is because of the support of six sponsors. So 475 High Performance Supply, Building Supply, sorry, Icon Windows and Doors, Enotech Windows and Doors, Partel, Prosico, and Source 2050. So these six sponsors have come together to underwrite this party. And we couldn't be more pleased to be co-hosting it with FIAS Alliance and to celebrate the Pacifist community and just have a blast. So if you're not coming to Chicago, maybe you should consider coming and joining us. It's going to be fun.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. Thanks again to all those supporters. Slipped in there, Source 2050. We've run out of time this week, but perhaps we should talk a bit more about that in the future, because it's kind of snuck in there.
Yeah, we do. We need to dedicate some time, because they just became a champion sponsor of the Pacifist Accelerator.
Yeah,
super exciting effort, it is. And it'd be fun to dive into that. Yeah,
we talk more about that later.
Yeah,
but something else coming up. It's a little over a month until International Pacifist Open Days, so now's a good time to get organized for that. 11th to the 13th of November. Contact your local affiliate if you're or just get yourself, if you know someone who's got a passive house, now's a good time to start organizing that to get the home open up, because I mean the impact of those open days is pretty massive in terms of people experiencing passive house sometimes for the first time and really getting inspired by what it feels like to walk inside a Passive House building. So check that out on the passivehouseinternational.org website for more information about International Passive House. Open days. Yeah. Awesome. Great interview again. Thanks, Zach. And we'll be back again next week on Passive House Podcast.